Session number 10420, Rule 37.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 37. You were talking about the Battle of Alamein.
Yes, we're talking about the 25-pounders. I think I mentioned perhaps, they don't make a bang and a thud, but they, as they power over your heads, it's like a whiplash. And it was terrifying at first, experience this barrage being poured over your head, but in the end it became almost a song with such regularity. Now, I think I've said there were 22 lifts before half-time, as it were, what you might call halfway house. One thing that did happen very quickly, the whole atmosphere was smoke, sand caused by the explosions, and mist, you might say, and then started figures with our arms up, just coming forward, looming out of the mist, the Germans and Italians surrendering. Now, after we'd done about 880 yards or something like that, we were fired at by enemy fire coming from our left and coming from our right across the front. And one had to hold up a bit while it until it stopped. Now, you may say, well, how did you know it was going on? Well, they had put in tracer, and we saw the tracer going past us, just about man height. Or even higher, and so one just stopped. But the tragedy was that in our enthusiasm, we must have walked over some of these Italians, single chaps, or ones and twos, who lay doggo as we walked across. And undoubtedly one of them killed my RSM page and killed the doctor who was tending. And also the good Sergeant Fairley, who you may remember played cricket for Crook and played cricket for the battalion in the days down in Dorset. They all three were killed together, and it was a great blow. And I think on the right, young Vickers, too, who had just come to the battalion and who was a splendid young junior officer, a well-known Durham family, and whose father was farmers and auctioneers and valuers, he too was killed. And I think he must have been killed by some of this fire that came down from the right. Now, some of battalion headquarters, John Jackson, another very good officer, he was taken prisoner by some Germans who laid doggo in the ground. And with one or two others, I think. He was captured or recaptured by our own armored cars later with all his captors. So he joined me later on during the course of the day. At the halfway line, or you might call it halfway line, were a row of dug-in tanks, which I've mentioned. And when we reached these tanks, we were to do a right wheel and face northwards as the northern edge of the bridgehead. And sure enough, we came across these seven dug-in tanks, and it was almost too good to be true that we should find them all there, and they should be our guide to the swing. In practically every one, the crews were still inside. And I remember walking up to one and the corporal shouting to me, "Stand back, sir, stand back." I've planted a limpet mine or a grenade that sticks onto these stuck onto the armor plating, and it just blew the whole thing, blew inwards and killed the crew. And I know A company I saw having great fun trying to set one alight. But we did the turn, and we got into the positions, and it so happened that we did it absolutely accurately. The positions we held were absolutely in the right place. Then the guns opened up again for the 8th and 9th Battalion to continue their advance. I think it was 2,500 yards eventually. To the El Rahman track. Meanwhile, we just waited for dawn, and of course, behind us were the sappers, New Zealand sappers, making a gap through the minefield through which we'd walked.
Were the mines for tanks, against tanks and vehicles rather than personnel?
Yes. Well, I don't know. I have a feeling some of them were anti-personnel mines. But it was very fortunate we were able to walk through. At 4 o'clock, the whole operation stopped. I mean, all the artillery stopped. And as I say, I think somebody worked out that there were at least 350 guns and something like 150,000 shells were fired over our heads. Now, when dawn appeared, I selected a slight hollow in the ground near one of these self-propelled guns, and during the course of the day we buried the Italian crew. Now, I could see all the three companies clearly, because I was only about 300 yards behind the center company. They were thin on the ground. It was a long length to hold. And we got in touch with the 8th Battalion when they got onto their objective, or as near as possible. The Germans themselves were in Sangen, about 400 yards beyond the beyond the companies. So they weren't very far away. And it wasn't advisable to do a great deal of walking about. But undoubtedly, the Germans were very jittery and very nervous. Of course, any movement that they made, the New Zealanders opened up with their machine guns. And it seemed as if the New Zealanders had their thumbs on the thumb pieces of the machine guns the whole time, because the slightest flicker of a German brought a hail of bullets, and so did we. We had our brain guns, and we watched them the whole time, and they couldn't move without courting rifle fire at them. Well, this went on all day. Bearing in mind, we've got to have a sack ration, so nobody could, we didn't want any food. But very early in the morning, Morris Kirby, Major Kirby, brought up the carriers and the anti-tank guns. So we had those with us. And I remember he bought some beer for A Company. Why A Company? I can't imagine. But A Company got some beer. I dare say I got some. I may have got some, but I really can't remember. Now, during the course of the day, an enemy signal wagon came into view. One of our anti-tank guns, only 2-pounders, took a pot shot at it and knocked it out at 900 yards. Well, it was far too far, but it was in absolutely an extreme range. And we actually subsequently measured the distance, and it was 900 yards. Knocked the signal, or German signal wagon, wireless wagon, knocked it completely out of commission. And then the brigadier came up, and the one and only time I ever saw him wearing a tin hat, Brigadier Percy, you see, had been in the First World War. He had won the MC. He'd been adjutant of the 9th Battalion, and then subsequently CO of it, and now he was the brigadier. And he was always awfully kind to me. I always felt he rather favoured me, possibly more than either of the others. Then during the day, too, I was visited by Jake Jackson, the CO of the 8th Battalion, who'd been our second in command, remember, in the Gazala line for a few days. And he was in an awful twitter. I mean, he was a very worried chap, and he really was on this occasion fearfully worried.
What was his problem, Colonel?
I really don't know, but I think they'd suffered some casualties on the right flank. You see, we went up one side, and they were along the front, and then the 9th Battalion, and then the Highlanders, and then there'd be a Highland Battalion facing them, having done a left wing. Well, the day wore on, just like this. The tanks came up and tried to get through, but they were knocked back by 88 millimeters. And some of them were burning, big black clouds of black smoke. But we ourselves just waited and couldn't do much except keep the Germans occupied the whole time. Well, now about 4 o'clock, some tanks came up behind us to go with a view to trying to get out through us northwards, you see. Then all of a sudden, to our absolute joy, 90 members of the 25th Panzergrenadier Regiment, including their CO, who was the equivalent of a brigadier, put their hands up. It was the most wonderful sight. You saw a row of Germans stand up out of the sangars and holes in the ground where they'd been, with their hands up, and they marched in. And Jimmy Chapman, who was one of my company commanders, he brought them in. I went over to the company and saw them all there. I knew that there wouldn't be much firing while they surrendered. And the brigadier was a great big tall man, a typical Prussian. He had his greatcoat on with collar, double-breasted greatcoat with very pronounced collars. And I asked him what his regiment was, and he said, do you speak German? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, I cannot tell you. And he apologized for the dirty state of all his men were in. And he was very concerned, too, about what some of his own staff, I think about two or three of them, were rather badly wounded. And I knew what the regiment was, because I had an intelligence sergeant who could speak German. And we soon found out who it, what it was. 21st Panzer Grenadier Regiment. And I put the CO in a carrier and sent him as quickly back as possible to brigade headquarters. And the other chaps, apart from the wounded, which we got back somehow or other in carriers, and we sent all the others back into captivity. But he bucked us up no end then. Nevertheless, the 88 millimeters were a nuisance, still being a nuisance at the time. And you had to be careful not to do too much, show too much activity. Just at dusk, at about 7 o'clock, the company three tunners came up with the greatcoats in the men's packs and an evening meal. And there was, they came very close to battalion headquarters, and an 88mm, German 88mm, opened up and smashed two and killed quite a number of the drivers and quartermaster sergeants. The quartermaster sergeant Robinson was one. He was one of my old Teesdale regulars, and he worked in Martin's Bank here in Barnecastle, and he was killed. He was a very good chap indeed. And they were all buried then and there on the spot. But some of the companies had to go without their greatcoats and without their evening meals. I think perhaps some evening meals were rescued. But, it was an unpleasant event. And then darkness fell, and I was told by the staff captain or the brigade major, I can't remember who it was, who came up and actually told me that we would be relieved by the New Zealand battalion that night. And it was a long and weary wait. About midnight, an 88mm gun drove straight into C Company's headquarters. It lost its way. And the crew were rather stupid. The C Company put a whole lot of tracer bullets into its petrol tank and set it alight. But the crew were rather stupid. They wouldn't get out. One did escape. Most of them were killed, and I think two were brought in to my battalion headquarters, I remember. And the corporal brought them in and said they'd been a bit stupid, so no, a bit nasty. And so, but they wouldn't get out of the cab, out of the gun, off the gun, and so, but they won't do it anymore. And two wretched Germans were brought in, and we kept them prisoner, I think. Well then, yes, they started to get a bit rough, I remember, that's what he said, but they won't do it again. By 4 a.m., the relief was affected. The New Zealanders came up. And then we started our long march back. We had to do the 5 miles or whatever it was back to Teresa Station from where we started. And I admit I was extremely tired. But we did it in column. There were no air trouble from the air. We did it in column. We started it back. We started it in column straight away and marched the whole way back. The 9th and the 8th Battalion were the same. It was one long brigade column. And as I say, I was particularly tired, and so I popped in an extra stop on the way back because I wanted to rest. And somehow we knew we'd been successful. The Australians told us. They were the Australians that should have been in the line, of course. They were behind. And they brought tea to us, the leading company. They gave me a cup of tea. And they told us that it had been a huge success. And we then got back to there was one chap fell out, and his company commander came to me and said, could he fall out? Yes, I said, certainly, what's the matter? He was shot in the shoulder yesterday, and he doesn't think he can make it. He was wounded, and he was still there, marching back to the rear area. And there were all the way back, of course, there were these fearful signs of war, derelict vehicles, dead drivers lying blackened by the vehicles, and other chaps just sleeping as we marched back to the, I think it would be about seven miles. And eventually, after 36 hours, we got back to where we started from. Breakfast was ready, eaten in silence. Every chap was very silent. And then every man just dropped to sleep. And there were three officers killed, four wounded, 47 others wounded, and 20 missing. And brigadier came round later that morning, I was lying almost comatose, asleep, and I remember he congratulated. He congratulated us, all the company commanders. He collected all the company commanders together, and he was so awfully good, nice to me. And he took me aside and said to me, "When I came up and saw your battalion headquarters, I knew it all was well, and I congratulate you. Everything was so unperturbed." And that was the Operation Took Charge.
Do you feel after such a quite a fierce action that the pride of the man in his unit was a factor in the fighting morale. In the fighting morale of a unit, where would you place the pride in his regiment and his battalion and his
company? Oh, I think it was very high. It was very high. Subsequently, when the new brigadier came and he walked round the battalion, this was sometime after this operation, he said to a Private Duggan, who was an Argyll and Southern Highlander, and the brigadier said to him, "I suppose you're one of the Argyll and Southern and Highlanders." And he said, "No, I'm not. I'm in the Durham Light Infantry." I was awfully proud of them. Everybody worked so well. It really was. And it's very difficult to tell you what it really meant walking under that fearful barrage and in the thick dust and the mist and smoke.
Were any of your battalion recommended for medals at all?
I put in a lot. Well, not a lot, but I put in a good many. And I can't remember now who got them. But it was a custom in the Durham Light Infantry to cut them down. There were very few. I did put in quite a number, but it wasn't automatic. Brigadier Percy told me to cut them down. But today, sitting here, it's very difficult to appreciate what it was like when we suddenly we started to walk through the minefields, and then all these vast number of guns opened up.
What about a strong religious belief? Do you know of yourself and officers and men who had that faith that helped them in matters in times of stress and danger?
Well, of course, yes. We had this splendid. We had a new padre now called Garbutt, and he was very good, but he wasn't as good as Davis. You just had faith, that's what it is. Tremendous faith.
How important is the role of a padre?
Very, very important. He's with the doctor, generally, and subsequently. A new doctor came after poor Gibson was killed. He would work with the doctor, and he would be in the regimental aid post. So when the wounded were brought in, he could tend to them and look after them. Mind, our padre was the C of E padre for the whole of the brigade. The 8th Battalion had Father Nesbitt of the RC, and the 9th Battalion had the Methodist parson, other denominations. And they were all very good, except the one who accompanied us out to the Middle East. He wasn't quite very good. He made off, wanted to go up to Jerusalem as soon as he set foot in Palestine. Never mind about the battalion. And he left us. He went into a hospital. There was a padre to the hospital.
In the aftermath, was there any occasion where you heard or had experience of someone who hadn't done well in the action at all?
No. I think everybody did the very best they could. It was undoubtedly their blood was up. My chap's blood was up. And as I think I've already said, it's extremely hard to control a company when the blood is up, if a barrage is going, because they're coming over their heads, because they'll walk into it if they don't go slowly and keep control of themselves. And some of my chaps certainly got ahead of the 8th Battalion because some of the 8th joined me. But it was an experience one will never forget.